Welcome to the Senate Education Workforce Committee. This is the first time we've ever started this late, so I apologize. I'm in a committee right before this, and the chair needed me right up until 3 o'clock to vote on a bill. And then, because I've been in committee all afternoon, I needed a short little break. So we have a full agenda today. Before we get started, I do want to introduce some young people we have visiting us. We have L.V. Quayler, freshman at Silverton High School. You can stand up. Juan Bolu, a junior at Newport High. Paige Greenlee, a senior at South Eugene High from my community. Jacob Struck, a senior at Madras High School. These students all serve on the youth advisory team to the Superintendent of Public Instruction, and we are so excited and pleased that you volunteer your time to do that. Welcome to the committee today. Okay, so my usual admonition is if you have a cell phone, you need to turn it off or put it on vibrate, because if I hear it, we'll ask you to make a contribution to the Common School Fund. Also, if you haven't signed up or have never been here to sign up, we have sign-up sheets on the side aisle. So we are first going to start out with a work session on Senate Bill 415, so I'll open a work session. Marjorie.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you heard Senate Bill 415 on the 7th and the 11th of February. As you remember, this is an ESD-related bill that was proposed by Senator Ringo, and this bill has a subsequent referral to revenue.
Okay, colleagues, what's happening with this bill is we started out hearing all of the ESD related stuff with this bill. Senator Ringo wants to continue working on his bill on other issues, so we're going to send it over to revenue, and you're going to hear all about the ESD restructuring in the next bill we have on our agenda. So that's basically what we're doing here today. So, Senator Starr, would you have a motion for me?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 415 to the Committee on Revenue.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 415 to the Committee on Revenue. Any discussion? Without recommendation, was that Senator Starr?
Without recommendation.
That would be good, since we haven't really done much with that bill. Okay, so the motion has been amended to be without recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none. Any objection? Then so ordered. Senate Bill 415 is going to you, Senator Deckert. Okay, are we just going to go down the list?
Yes.
Okay. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 765. And Marjorie, tell us about that bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 765 is also an ESD bill. As printed, it would direct the Board of Education to enter into an order to merge ESDs based on specific criteria and other associated items. However, the Dash 3 amendment was developed by the work group that formed after we heard testimony on Senate Bill 415. And there are some people in the audience who would like to talk about that amendment. This bill also has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue at this time.
Okay. Colleagues, Senate Bill 765, we appointed a work group. It started out with Senate Bill 415, and Senator Cruz was appointed to chair that work group, and he has done a bang-up job with his able group of folks involved in that, and I had my list of who all was involved, and it disappeared on me in the mix, but I think between Senator Cruz and I, we can recognize those people. We have Vicki Fleming with the department. We had James Sager from the governor's department, the governor's office. We had Judy May
from Lake
ESD. County ESD. We had Rick Howell from Coos County, South Coast ESD. Dr. John Hill from Douglas County ESD, and Craig Rossler from the Silverton Falls School District. Yeah, does that cover it?
Well, and we had some other people coming in and out over time.
And Senator Ringo was there also. So these folks, Senator Cruz, how many weeks, how many times did you meet?
We met forever.
Okay, I know that.
I think five meetings.
Okay.
So today.
Five times over 6 weeks. So these folks have really done a good job. And so we're going to hear from folks today to present the bill. Senator Cruz, did you want to, Vicki Fleming and James Sager, who are in the work group, do you want to join with them down there and present that? So you two want to come up? I just want to let folks in the audience know we are not going to move this bill today. And the reason for that is there are some people who would like to cogitate over the amendment a little bit more, and we got permission to hold on to the bill for just a tiny bit of time to continue working on that. So that's sort of the story on that. And then Senator Cruz, Dr. Hill is here also in the audience, and so maybe when you're done testifying, you can give up your seat and he can come join you, join the other folks at the table. Okay, we're ready to roll. I did open a public hearing.
I did. Good.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Cruz, State Senator, District 1. First off, let me say what this bill doesn't do. This bill does not touch the funding formula. It doesn't even address the funding formula in any way, shape, or form. And that may have been one of the things we were looking at on the front end of this thing. But basically, the guidelines we set out for ourselves when we convened the work group was, number one, we weren't going to be spending a lot of time looking back at the bad things that had happened. Our purpose was to look forward as to what needed to be developed and not look forward just for this biennium, but look forward to what the education system needed and should look like 10, 20 years down the road. And that was basically the premise we started with. And you know, the whole dynamic in education is changing to a large degree because of the new requirements of No Child Left Behind, and the fact that the department is now having to collect data at a much more microscopic level than before. I mean, the data is tied to the child, and so the need to develop a data system is paramount from the perspective of the department. I think Vicki will attest to that. In fact, they have already started working in that direction. So we looked, number one, at what ESDs currently are and how they should deliver those services. And there is, if I can find the section of the bill, we do speak to core services, and I believe it's section 10 on page 8 of the bill. So it was a fairly well-defined set of core services that should be addressed. But when we looked at what ESDs are and what they could be and how they could support the state education system, we got into administrative functions and the data collection systems. And that's basically what the first part of the bill, section 2, deals with. I'm not going to go into detail, but if you read the first few sections of this bill, it's fairly detailed, and I think we've really kind of gone out of the box and really looking into the future as to what the system needs to look like and what sort of matrix needs to be developed. There's 198 school districts in the state. How much sense does it make for this level of detail, this level of information, for the matrix to be 198 points on the department? It really makes very little sense whatsoever. There needs to be a nexus there, and what we're calling what is ESDs now and what will be area service agencies will be that nexus. And we think it's appropriate so that folks in school districts will have something a little close, somebody a little closer to the ground to help them with technical support, help them make sure the reports are coming in appropriately. Now, we also understand that it's going to take a few years for this information system to be fully developed, but it makes sense for us to put together the structure for that on the front end so that the department has the ability to look at the structure they have in place as they're developing the system. This is, you know, I will have to admit that when the chair assigned me this task force or this work group, as it is, basically because I spoke up at the wrong time in committee one day,
I think.
Yeah, you know.
There were much more.
Yeah, we have the right in this country to remain silent. It seems like I very seldom exercise that right.
Actually, Senator, I recognize some really great skills in you, and that's why I put you on the work group.
I appreciate that. What we've come up with was far exceeds my initial expectations. I think this is a work product I'm very proud of, and I think those that are sitting at the table would probably agree on that. You know, and I'd also point out that on all issues, you might not find me sitting at the same table with these same folks, but on this one, we certainly do. You know, we'll let the department and the governor's office go into the detail of what the new thing looks like. I don't need to do that. And I mean, I was looking at this and figuring out how I capsulize this, because it's really an amazing piece of work. And I also want to acknowledge Cindy Hunt, who did this and did an absolutely magnificent job. I mean, she's very, very good. I was very impressed. So
I think we have a great staff in the Legislative Council office, and Cindy Hunt is in that top tier, so we do recognize her. Okay. Thank you.
One of the things about this, how we develop this new system is, and this is going to sound really strange to folks, is as far as what this new delivery model, number one, this does not necessarily eliminate any ESDs as they currently sit. It does not necessarily do that. The case has to be made. But the difference here, and why we didn't draw a map, is because we don't know specifically at this point in time exactly what the map should look like, because we're going to this new delivery model for a new set of services. But the interesting part of this is that the decision about how any map should look, whether it's for this information system or the core services ESDs currently provide, that decision will be driven by input directly from the school districts. So the school districts get to decide how they want their services delivered. And we think that's appropriate. We did try to address some ways to capture some of the quote-unquote problems that have been happening over time and the accountability levels, and there will be administrative rules written around entrepreneurial activities and a few of the other things that seem to have caused some angst over time. But I would say outside of the two sections I've already mentioned, probably the other biggest change is the change we made in the governance structure. And what we did in the governance structure is we did this in a way that ties ESDs more directly to school districts. And this is what an ESD board in the future will look like. It will be a 9-person board. Each ESD will be divided into 5 sections regionally based on population. So in a Douglas County, for example, where you have one really large school district and then a lot of smaller ones, Roseburg actually accounts for 2 of the 5 just based on population, so there's equal representation. Those 5 ESD board members will be selected or chosen by the school boards in each region. So there, and it doesn't have to be a school board member. It can be a member of the community. But the school boards will choose a representative for their region on the board. The other 4 positions, one will be a member of an institution of higher education. In most cases, it would be somebody from the community college, but it wouldn't necessarily have to be. Another member will be somebody from the social service side of things, because quite simply, the nexus between programs delivered from the Department of Ed and the Department of Human Services in schools needs to be addressed, and we think this is a good place to address it. Another member will be from the business community, and that gets into how we move towards our K-20 system and workforce development. And so we think that's important. And the last member will be an at-large position to allow each ESD to select somebody to fill a unique niche that that ESD may need to have filled. And so that will be the board. We've also changed the structure of the budget committee. And the budget committee now will, it's still a 10-person committee, but it will be made up of two superintendents or their designees from each of the five regional regions within the ESD. And this does not preclude members of the board from sitting in on the budget committee, but this is, I mean, if we're going to a business model and we're going to that way of looking at the service delivery matrix, it makes sense to have the people that are involved in the business of the schools sit on that board. Those are the three areas of major changes. We'll let people with more expertise than me speak to a little more of the detail of it. I think this is a good body of work. We are obviously interested in some changes. I'm hoping, because this doesn't impact revenue, that we can get the referral to the Committee on Revenue rescinded, because this does have an impact on the department's budget, because this would be directing some of their resources specifically to this body of work. And so I think it would be appropriate ultimately for this bill to go to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. I'll ask you to come back up here and join us so Dr. Hill can come up here, and we'll have him on hand if he'd like to offer some testimony. And then Ms. Fleming, do you want to start, or Mr. Sager, whichever wishes to go first?
For the record, I'm James Sager from the Governor's Office, and I will, along with the panel here, I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 765, what's now the -3 amendment before you. Chair Walker and members of the committee, as Senator Cruz kind of outlined for you, we started out this journey several weeks ago with kind of a different viewpoint, and that was to consolidate ESDs. And as we delved into it, we realized that there were a lot of big picture issues and challenges that we felt need to be dealt with. And so this work group really came together. I want to compliment Senator Cruz for the way he coordinated this work group and for all the members that participated, because I think we did a pretty good job of addressing these several issues. I want to, if Senator Cruz kind of looked at this from 50,000 feet, I'm going to bring us down to 25,000 feet and we'll kind of work our way into the heart of the bill. There are, in my opinion, kind of four major areas, and Senator Cruz somewhat touched on that. Number one is No Child Left Behind does require us to now have what's called a regional delivery system. But even aside from No Child Left Behind, the Department of Education, our 198 school districts, and our over 1,200 schools need a regional delivery and support system to help them, help our students and our schools be successful. And that really became kind of a driving force for us to propose the establishing of these regional education service agencies. Vicki Fleming will go into a lot more detail about this delivery system and why it is absolutely crucial for the department. But I want to emphasize what Senator Cruz said, and that is we're not imagining creating another layer or another level of agencies in this system, but rather take what we have, retool it into a system that is going to carry us for the next 20, 30, 40 years. The other thing that we heard was that some of our districts at different times have felt either disconnected or ignored by their ESDs. And so we really wanted to address that issue. And that we approach it from the standpoint of how the governance structure is set up. And so that's why we recommended this change in the board structure of the ESD, so there's a direct link to their local school districts. And also the change on the budget committee, because we all know that if the local school districts are connected in the development of the budget that goes with the program, they have a much tighter connection. And I think the other real important component of this section was changing the language from where it suggested that the local school districts could, in essence, give input into the creation of a local service plan to making them an at-the-table partner in the creation of that local service plan with ESDs. Now, many of our ESDs already follow this process, so it's not going to be a big change for many of them. But it is one of the issues that cropped up that indicated why there may have been problems in the past, disagreements between local school districts and their ESDs, because there was a disconnect between who was kind of creating the local service plan and the local districts that needed to use those services and the students that they provide. We think that this will help address that. The other issue, and it has come up often, and that is these entrepreneurial activities that the ESDs carry out. Now, many of us remember that it wasn't that long ago that ESDs were encouraged to expand their horizons to try and go out, and many of them did. But we realized that, again, brought up many concerns for members of the work group as well as local school districts and others. And so we put in place in this bill three new control features, I would call them, in these kind of entrepreneurial activities. First, the activity has to be presented in the form of a business plan to the new budget committee, approved by the budget committee and sent and approved to the new ESD board, that in fact they can move ahead with it. And that activity must fall within the guidelines that the Department of Education, the State Board of Education, will create, so that there are clear guidelines for ESDs, for local school districts, to know how do these services help support the local plan, help support the school districts, and most importantly, help support the students, which is the service, really our focus of the service delivery. The other thing that we're adding is that these activities need to be audited. There's been questions raised about, well, do they really provide additional resources or services or programs for students in the districts? And one way to be very open and clear with this is to have those activities audited, so that way we can follow the cost, income, benefit to the students in the districts in a very clear and open manner, and put that out front for people and have full disclosure on it. The fourth area that that we created in this bill was, as Senator Cruz mentioned, rather than trying to have the work group hammer out a map or the legislature hammer out a map, we used the criteria that the Oregon Association of Education Service Districts provided, as well as additional criteria that we put together to say, here are the parameters in which these new regional education service agencies should operate, their abilities, their capacities to deliver services and to help students, and a process whereby this state superintendent of public instruction will go out for input from the local school districts to get their input, to talk about geography. I mean, school districts in Eastern Oregon are much further apart than they are in the Portland area. There are different needs there. To talk about, the service delivery systems that we can provide in different parts of the state. And laid out a timeline that will have this all in place to begin July of 2007. And the reason for the two-year process, the first year gives time for the superintendent to gather the input, put together a recommendation to the State Board of Education to, in essence, put in place the order if there's to be any merger or any division or any new boundaries to be created. And then a second year whereby we can transition and we can put in place all the pieces, all the changes that we might need because of that order, so that the schools, the school districts, and the ESDs, or now the regional education service agencies, can be in place and ready to go July of 07. So those are four of the major areas. I'm going to turn over to Vicki and John to go into some other details, and then we'll be happy to answer questions.
Jim, just one point. Okay. The ultimate decision of any redistricting is not with the superintendent. It's with the State Board of Education.
State Board of Education.
So,
correct.
And we thought that was an appropriate nexus.
Yes, thank you.
Senator Walker, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Fleming, Deputy Superintendent at the Oregon Department of Education. I have very much enjoyed being a part of the work group. I don't know what I'm going to do with my Tuesday night from now on.
Never appreciate it. Be careful what you ask for.
Yeah. I'm not going to repeat, hopefully, much of what James said about the reasons that we got into this. I think you've heard from us on numerous occasions that we reorganized at the department, and much of what we did in our reorganization was predicated on the idea that we would have a regional delivery system in partnership with education service districts that would be directing our existing capacity more effectively to improve schools and ultimately student achievement. And we're still dedicated to that mission. I might mention as well that we have very much appreciated the collaborative nature of the work with the Oregon Association of Education Service Districts. They've been ready to come forward and grapple with the really hard requirements of No Child Left Behind and think with us about how we could work together better and to re-examine the role of an intermediary organization and to talk about how we might move forward. I think in our reorganization, again, we've been talking about an enterprise approach, connecting communities to schools, and in that particular regard, the role of an intermediary organization such as education service districts, and what is it that you do when you don't have new capacity, you use your existing capacity differently. You probably all remember that we send over $200 million worth of direct service contracts out through the education service districts on a biennial basis. We depend on them for getting services to kids, primarily special needs, youth corrections, education, regional programs, early intervention, juvenile detention. All of those things could not happen without that service delivery organization. So we got to this conversation with some very hard questions about how to do that, how to move forward and use the capacity that we have in a different way. I would point to the article that I handed out that's titled School Officials Say Student Achievement is Improving from the Center on Education Policy, just came out last week, as one of the primary reasons why we need to continue to have this discussion with you and with the system. No Child Left Behind, raise the bar, up the ante, requires not only that we be more accountable for the results for all of our children in our school system, but it requires that we collect and analyze a great deal more data and information about what we're doing and what outcomes we're achieving. As Senator Cruz mentioned, we have a proposal before this body to begin the work on an integrated data system that will help us in an enterprise fashion manage the information that we have more effectively, consolidate some of the technical infrastructure that we have around the state. We have, I believe, around 40 data centers that operate their own student information systems. When it comes time for us to collect data through those 40 systems, it doesn't always get to us in a manner that makes it easy for us to get it analyzed and turned back around in a way that anybody can use it. So we really grappled, I think, and need to continue to grapple with three major questions. Are we really an enterprise and a system of educational institutions or not? Are we all after the same objectives or not? And are we about preserving jobs and institutions and the status quo, or are we about better outcomes for kids? And those are really the questions that we have to grapple with at a policy level with you. I would point to page 2, line 6, where you see here that there are some major capacity issues that are described in the bill. What would help us greatly from a state perspective is that we have a system that has somewhat standardized its capacity to deliver a variety of things. The first that's described here is the ability to provide high-quality administrative services and programs, and you can read for yourself what that means. You've heard the governor talk on numerous occasions and Superintendent Castillo talk about our need to create capacity and efficiency and consolidate perhaps business and payroll functions, oversee contracts more effectively, school district administrative functions in general. What would that look like? We don't know. This bill gives us the opportunity to go out and take a hard look at that. On line 21, it talks about supporting school district performance improvement. The activities described therein, that directly speaks to what this article from the Center for Education Policy really describes, which is a nationwide crisis in our ability to support school improvement with the level of capacity that we have. We don't have enough. We simply can't help every school that ends up in that category of needing improvement or not making adequate yearly progress to represent what the research says works and what professional development is needed and what community involvement and parent engagement needs to happen. Those are very labor-intensive activities. So then on page 3, line 7, establish and maintain and develop the technology infrastructure. These regional education service or education service agencies that we're talking about would have some consistent and standard capacity to deliver and with us work with us on that technology infrastructure and translate and communicate data as described here. And then finally on the line 23, provide direct services to students, including special education. That's largely what I just mentioned earlier with the $200+ million worth of contracts that we send out. I'll stop there and let you hear from a real live ESD superintendent. The superintendent of public instruction, Susan Castillo, and the department are very much in support of this bill and believe that moving forward is about building an enterprise that works better for kids and works better for the state of Oregon. And it definitely is a work in progress, and we're committed to stay the course. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sharon Walker. My name is Jonathan Hill. I am the superintendent of the Douglas Education Service District, and the last time I spoke before you and the members of your committee, you were in Roseburg, and I was there presenting the original version of Senate Bill 765, which was developed by the Education Service Districts over the course of every 2 or 3 months prior to that. I guess what I would like to do today, I brought the answer book. So anybody who has questions about what it is that we did or how it is that we got there, I did bring the answer book and be glad to do that. I'm involved in this, speaking strictly personally, I'm involved in this project and have committed my time because I believe strongly that public education, as the funding continues to grind down, has got to at some point stop and say we need to re-examine the whole activity. We cannot just continue to take away a few dollars and spending power year after year after year and continue going forward. We need to make a change. Now, Senator Cruz and I don't completely agree that we've reached that point, but I believe strongly that this bill exists to cause that to happen, for ESDs and school districts to sit down in a new partnership that's stronger and more closely tied to what districts are trying to do and take a look at all of the money that's going into the education service district as well as how that fits with districts and redesign the mousetrap, to build a better mousetrap, because we simply cannot go forward taking less and less money or money with less and less spending power year after year after year and say that we can just continue to thin the soup. I think we need to take some kind of action. I very much appreciate the opportunity to serve with this group. This was an exciting time and an exciting group to work with. And I believe that the product from the frontline point of view does what I hoped it would do, and that is to create and to reinvigorate that conversation so we can look again at the available resources and say, how is it we do the best job for kids? Thank you.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Marjorie, would you? thank you very much. I totally support the ESD system. I said this very early on. I continue to say it. I do not want to see the integration of reduction of numbers. Saturday, our Lane County delegation met with the school. We met at 4J, and most of the school districts were there, and we did discuss this issue. And Ron Hitchcock, the superintendent, was there, and I do have. I guess I'll have to make one extra of these available. We have a list of all of the schools. We have the amount of money that is spent on special ed, and out of the total, they spend 87% on special ed of the money that they get. And the concern of everyone who was there and spoke said, any cut in funding from the ESD would be passed directly to the schools. Now, there is seems like a mandated maintenance of effort. And the concern is with the new proposals that you have mentioned, there is some concern that that would cut into the existing funding, which is going to be the same. Now, I'm not going to go any further than that. I'll make copies of these for you, and I know that this will be discussed in great detail with a lot of people, a lot of individual school districts will give their input, and they probably already have. But those were some of the concerns, that there be a actual loss in funding due to new, well, I hate to use the word unfunded mandates on the ESDs to perform new programs that they haven't performed before, taking money away from programs that they already have. And so I just wanted to express that concern, and I will ask that a copy of this be made for you to take a look at, and so if you have a response to that.
Chair Walker, Senator Morsad, what I would observe is that the difference between the existing system and what's being proposed here is, under the existing system, the school districts, in doing the planning model Mr. Sagan made reference to, sit down and they generate their agenda, and they determine what are the issues we want to look at and how we're going to apply ESD resources to that. The distinction is that under this agenda, under this proposal, there's a fixed agenda that districts and ESDs need to respond to. You cannot take a bye on a tough question, but how you then use your ESD resources remains every bit as flexible under this model as it is under the current model. It doesn't change that, but it does mean that you have to ask a specific set of, you have to go down the list of all the questions, including the tough ones. You may change what you do. You're permitted to do that, but you're also permitted to maintain a very much the same kind of program you have in place today. It does not require you do that. You may simply look at a tough issue that doesn't, you don't have ESD funding for, and now you're going to approach it through a contract or through some other mechanism, but to cover that solution or a solution to that particular issue. But you can maintain all your current programs, and this does not force you to change them.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Senator Morsad, were they responding to the Dash 3 amendments?
Well, I hadn't seen the Dash 3 amendments at the time, and they were not mentioned. But I did talk with Ron Hitchcock this morning, and he had the Dash 3 amendments. I had just received them from Marjorie, and so he pointed out in the Dash 3s what he was talking about. But I guess the concern was, if there are unintended consequences of being asked to do things that they're not funded for, and if that has come out of the special ed, then that goes directly to the school district, the special ed. So that, okay. Those are their concerns, and I'm sure you're going to hear it in great detail.
Madam Chair, Senator Morsad, I just want to add to that. I share that concern, and right now, we biennially receive about $350 million in federal funds, and most of that money flows through the department out to the local district. And in regard to school improvement activities, most of the money for Title I schools, for example, goes directly to the district. The ESD doesn't get any of that money. There are examples around the state, and I would point right here in Salem to Willamette Education Service District, where they have created a coalition, the Willamette Curriculum Coalition, which is the curriculum folks from all of the 21 districts, not sure how many Willamette ESD has at this point in time, but they come together and in fact they have the opportunity to talk about collectively what they want to focus their efforts on, what the data tells them they ought to be spending time worrying about, and they can then buy back from the ESD with their federal funds, if they so choose, some of those services, collective grant writing, which then gives them more resources regionally. So there are reasons to do this. The other question that comes up often in my conversations with ESD superintendents is, how are we going to pay for doing your work, meaning the Department of Education? I've worked at an ESD, and now I work at the department. I believe that it's all our work, and so how do we figure out how to get that done together? And I think the association has been very helpful in that regard.
Madam Chair, I guess I was most impressed with the individual superintendents from some of the districts who were there. They're the ones who were complaining. And Ron Hitchcock was trying to respond to their complaints. So they're concerned that they will have to take on more of their own, you know, the special ed obligations. I will give this.
Okay.
The only copy I have left. Could you give it to me?
And Ms. Taylor noted that at the bottom of the email is an attachment that says it's the Dash 3, so they apparently have the Dash 3.
Madam Chair, if I could respond, number one, whenever you do changes, everybody's going to be uncomfortable, and I understand that. What I'm confused about currently, an ESD board to a large degree has a certain amount of autonomy as to how they develop their plan. With the reconfiguration of the board, where the school districts themselves are directly connected to not only the board but also the budget committee, I don't see how a concern of a school gets overlooked in this. If it's something that a school district wants an ESD to provide that they haven't been, I mean, they're sitting right at the table to have that discussion. So I think there's a stronger connection. I would think there would be a greater comfort level from the schools. Maybe it's just trying to grasp this. I don't know.
May I respond? I think it is. I'm not. I can't speak to the merit of this from my background. I have a general impression of what ESD is doing, but I'm not even sure of all of the possible funding sources. But there was a discussion, and it was concerned with unintended consequences. Is all.
And yes, and Senator Cruz, I'm sorry, I wasn't at the meeting Saturday. I was out of state, so I wouldn't be able to comment any further on that. Senator Morsen, did you have anything further?
No.
Okay. Did any of you want to comment? Okay. Well, again, I thank you all for your tremendous service on the work group.
May I just make one?
Yes. Okay.
I'm grateful that you have done the work that you have just completed, and it will go through a vetting process. And I'm very concerned about the preservation of the flexibility of the ESDs, and I was concerned that the consolidation issue would cause some real damage, and it apparently that's not going to happen. So I congratulate you on the work that you've done, and you will have to vet it and so on and talk to the school districts, and I believe that's where the discussion should take place with the school districts to see what their misconception is, perhaps, of the plan.
Well, Senator Morsen, I need to correct your misunderstanding. I mean, it may not be a misunderstanding, but there could be consolidation under this plan. Not a shall, but it's a strong may. So it is a shall, because I asked for it to be a shall when I was in the work group.
I'm sorry, Chair Walker, we don't have a predetermined number
right.
We're going to change to, but I also think that's important for Senator Morsett for you to understand. That's why we put that process in place,
yeah.
So that, in fact, the local district will have input. One size doesn't fit all in this criteria. We have the core services that we're saying all school districts, all schools should have access to through their new regional agency, but the local plans will be developed by the local school districts with the ESD. Like I said, many of the ESDs already follow that process. That's wonderful. This puts in place that process so that way we make sure that the local school districts are at the table in that creation.
Okay.
Yes, and wait, hang on.
Okay.
I know everybody wants to speak, and Senator Deckert's in the queue also.
Okay.
On page 5, section 5, line 8, I knew there was a shall in there somewhere because I remember at the work group it was a may, and I said, no, that shall be a shall. On or before March 31, 2006, the State Board of Education shall enter an order to merge or divide existing education service districts based on the plan adopted by the board. So there is anticipated some merger. But what this bill does, which I think is really great, instead of us drawing the map, which we could have easily done, we are going out in the district, and the district has a choice in it. The school district, the ESDs, everyone who lives and works in those communities has a voice. Instead of us doing it, that's the plan. Did I answer your question?
Yes, but I want to comment on it.
Okay, let me get to Senator Deckert, and then I'll get back. Senator Deckert.
Thank you. So I'm going to be just a little, I'll be out in just a second. I'm just going to be a little bit contrary to that, to what I just heard, because here's my take, and tell me, first, thank you so much for the Tuesday night that you spent developing this. To me, the notion behind it, the guiding principle behind it, was efficiencies, of trying to squeeze out efficiencies, as Dr. Hill said, that we have a state that is investing less and less by the day in public education, and so where do you find better uses of the existing dollars? And so this is where I get at least a flag goes up in the back of my head is it doesn't prescribe how many districts, and I think we have a tendency to sometimes do this, the really difficult choices in here to me would be actually saying, and this work group is a good place to have that, and actually having a biennial legislature helps this too, because we meet once every 2 years and we can use the excuse we don't have a lot of time, so sometimes we have to put numbers down. And I guess what is missing here for me, or one thing to care about, is one, it doesn't have a number down of how many ESDs there would be, and then secondly, it prescribes a wide window of over 2 years to actually get to this unspecified number. And to me, if I was king for a day, I would put a number down and shorten that date up to really cause, if it's efficiencies that we're after, then I guess my two cents, Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, is let's do the hard work necessary, but now, rather than punt this discussion for 2+ years onto an unspecified number of ESDs.
Go ahead, John.
What this does is unique. This debate has happened, I've personally been involved since 92, and it's been happening since, I think, 65, is we keep having a discussion which would, in work group I referred to as apples, oranges, and Buicks. And the reason for that is that we not only talk about what's the best educational way, what's the best way to deliver an educational service, we also talk about geography, and then we also talk about how many local government jobs we're providing through the ESD, which that's where the Buicks come in. We've got such an array of issues. What we've done here that's different is we have been fairly specific about these are the criteria we're going to look at, and this is how we're going to do the comparisons, and we're going to under this bill structure an apples to apples look at some different configurations and pitch it out to districts. That discussion has never happened anywhere in the state. It's always descended in the apples, the oranges, and the Buicks, and it's never had any rational way to get at it. So I understand what you're saying, and I don't fully disagree with it, but I do think that this is going to cause a different discussion than we've ever had before, as Senator Walker said, by all the players who have an interest. And I think that discussion needs to happen to do this really the best way. I did point out that it talks not just about mergers, but also about divisions. So some of those where people have said, oh, that was a lousy idea, there's an opportunity here to go back and look and determine whether it was a lousy idea and they should go left and they should go right or not. So it's a really, really complex issue. What we've tried to do is to lay out a roadmap that's precise enough that it can have a wide understanding and buy-in and lead to that apples-to-apples look at what is the best way for us to do this. These things are all a balance. What's the best way?
Chair Walker, Senator Deckard, mm-hmm. I agree with you on the efficiencies. I mean, that is a important thing that we have to keep in front of us, but we also have to look at an effective delivery system. We can find some efficiencies and find out that they are not good for our students and not good for our schools and our school districts. So we want to make sure that it's efficient and effective. I think the other piece is what Senator Moore said commented on, which was the unintended consequences. We want to make sure that we have tried to identify and address the consequences that may or may not come about. And the third piece is, it's really not a two-year window, it's a one-year window. Mm-hmm. It's during the first year that we're getting the input, the superintendent will put the order together and the state board will act on it. The second year is time to make that transition. We can't simply throw the switch and July 1 of 05, for instance, have a new system in place. It's going to take some time to implement the order. That's the second year. So we're really taking the next 12 months and saying, now we have to do the hard work to figure out what the best, efficient, and effective system is so that it can carry us then into the future.
And if I could interrupt, Mr. Sager, on that note, for Senator Deckard's edification, the reason it takes some time to transition is because if we have mergers, which we likely will, we have collective bargaining issues, we have employees that we need to deal with.
Assets, liabilities, all sorts of
bonding issues, and I mean a whole number of things.
Right, yeah. So that's why it takes that additional amount of time. Ms. Fleming, did you have a response before Senator Deckard asked another question?
A short one. Senator Walker, Senator Deckard. We have been in Ways and Means for days, and Senator Walker knows because she's been there with us, and have been admonished over the years in education to operate more like a business. So we're trying to do that in this particular instance, and I think what we haven't done when we've had this discussion in the past is we haven't thought through the business case analysis of what this enterprise needs to look like, top to bottom, 198-20, including 17 community colleges and 7 universities, and how can the capacity and resources that exist there be shared? I personally would love it if you all would come up with a number and stick with it and actually vote it out. I don't think that's going to happen, and I think the reason that we came to this compromise language was so that we could go out, build the business case, come back to you with hard data and information about what needs are represented in the system. We have put out a proposal for IBM to do the business case analysis of the integrated data system. They're going out, they're assessing the current computing capacity statewide, they're looking at what is, and they're going to come back to us with a recommendation about how much it's going to cost to actually get us from here to where we want to go. I don't think anybody in any of the past task force reports that I've read has done that with the enterprise of education. So I agree with you. It would be great if we had a clear consensus on how it should look today. We don't. And I've heard on a regular basis from the small rural frontier ESDs about the concern about losing jobs and why are you tweaking around with us when all the money and resources that are represented are in the big metro ESDs. And been accused of having this be a power grab from the Department of Education. It's none of those things. It is doing our job to make sure that the system works better and more effectively and uses its resources more efficiently.
So, Madam Chair, my only, I got to unfortunately depart. And you, I mean, my strong inclination is just to lean heavily on the work of a group that's met for 6 Tuesday nights. But the only 2 cents I would throw on the table is that I heard the word this task force. And I don't know how many of them, I'm going to guess 4, 5, or 6 different efforts have been at this. And so it'll be 2 years before another group assembles on this dais to actually vote upon laws that affect schools in the state. And I'm not one that, I guess, would be one of those who admonishes to act like a business. But I do think that if this was a business, if we were, and that would be the great thing of having a CEO is you'd have probably county school districts. I don't know if you have any ESDs and all the political entanglements that come with, well, this is a jobs issue. To me, I mean, being able to stand back from this a little bit, if that's possible, we're nibbling at the edges. And by not prescribing a number, we're just further nibbling at the edges. Because I think it's feasible that y'all would know better than me is that we're going to come back here and find that because of the internal, and tell me I'm wrong, I'd love to hear it, we only merged 4 or 5 when our ultimate goal was at least to get down to 12 or to 10 ESDs in the state.
Could I respond, Madam Chair?
Sure.
Okay. In all due respect, Senator Decker, that's an arbitrary number. I drew a great map. I mean, I loved my map, and it got us down to 14. And on so many levels, I think it worked wonderfully. But then, I think we did maps week 3, didn't we? Yeah. And it was a lot of fun. But ultimately, what it comes down to is the number isn't as important as the services. And we want, when we get into the administrative functions and the information functions, there are clearly going to be economies of scale in here that are going to drive this. So we could draw maps now, but number one, that doesn't let the school district over here say, I've been with them for a long time, I'd rather be with them. We want to give them that flexibility. And number two, we want the people out there that are actually doing the work, delivering the service, to be able to come and say, okay, these are the criteria we have to meet to deliver the service. We think this would work. It would have made Vicki's job a lot easier if we'd have drawn a map. But the more I dug into this thing, the more I thought I would rather let and trust me, we can't go to a pure business model. We can come close to it. But to assume that education is a pure business model is not right, because it isn't. But we're coming closer to it, and I think that's important. But you know, there was just a consensus of the group that we let the need for the system drive the map rather than us arbitrarily doing it.
May I just make...
I just want to caution the committee. We have three other people on this bill we need to hear from, and we have a big agenda.
I guess the false economy is what I'm looking at, and be sure that when you consolidate or cut, you look at the downside of what it does to the service that you're providing. And I think that's absolutely essential, and that's probably why this has been talked about for 10 years and nothing has been done, because there probably is not an equitable solution. It'll be interesting to see what you shall come up with in terms of cutting. So.
Okay. Thank you both, or all three of you. we're going to hear from Rob Myers. Mr. Myers has come from more than 100 miles. Are you in the room? And I think Mr. Myers has an opposing view. Did you have written testimony, sir?
I didn't want to submit.
Okay.
Thank you for asking.
My name is Rob Myers, for the record. I live in Condon, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. Here we are again, talking about the same thing. At first, I'd like to take the opportunity to thank Senator Cruz and the task force or the work group for the work that they've done. It wasn't easy, and Lord knows it's not going to get any easier, I don't suspect. I think it's important from our perspective, and I'm speaking on behalf of the five Frontier Rural ESDs, as I always do, and that's North Central, Grand, Harney Lake, and Wallawa. And I would have to say that I sort of agree with Senator Deckert that the hackles went up on the back of my neck when I saw the criteria and looked through it, quite frankly. I believe that the intent of the criteria is not to force merger upon any of the ESDs, even though that's what the bill says it shall do, because I'm not real sure, quite frankly, that all 20 of the ESDs that currently exist can't meet that criteria either now or on or before March 31st, 2006. Our people are fairly comfortable that we can. So then that leads me to wonder, why have it at all if we're already all doing it? Now, I understand that there's a need to prove that, but I also think it's important to, from our perspective, to figure out whether or not there's a problem before we have to come up with a solution. And I would submit to you that necessarily the work of the five Frontier Rural ESDs is significantly different than any other ESD in the state. There are eight smallest ESDs, and I think, in fact, Senator Ringo referred to those eight smallest ESDs when he said there really wouldn't be any reasonable significant savings realized by consolidating those in the first place. But, and certainly with regard to the five small ESDs, and I think I've said this before, but I'm going to say it in the record again, the five small ESDs collectively represent less than 3% of the total revenues of the ESD situation in the state of Oregon right now. They represent less than 4% of the total revenues and budgets of the six largest ESDs in the Northern Willamette Valley. So if we're going to look at realizing savings in terms of greater efficiencies, it seems to me that we would want to look where the money is. Now, I'm not casting dispersions on the large ESDs. That's not my point. It's never been our position to suggest that anyone should be consolidated, particularly when we're suggesting that we should be held harmless from such. We have neither the expertise nor the experience to be able to tell the large ESDs how to run their business, and I would suggest to you respectively or respectfully that that inverse is true as well. The five Frontier Rural ESDs 2 years ago formed an ORS 190 entity by intergovernmental agreement. And quite frankly, if you want to shine a bright light on that agreement, it provides all the efficiencies and all the advantages that is currently being suggested that we should provide through consolidation. This is a vehicle that, if used properly, can act exactly the same way. We have also offered between and among the five small ESDs in the interest of being good partners with the Department of Education and their concerns in terms of information gathering and database, that we would build, maintain, and provide for the Department of Education a virtual resource center that would give them a single point of contact to all five ESDs in the 30 school districts those ESDs represent. It will be a secure portal that your Department of Education can go to and get any information they want to get, anything that they deem that they need necessary. I would also, and I hate to use the word myself, unfunded mandate, but I think Senator Morissette's concerns are closely mirror ours in that if we don't know exactly what some of that criteria means, how do we know that there's no fiscal impact as a result of having forced upon schools? I mean, that's a concern of ours as well. I'm concerned also. There's a lot of consolidation of not only suggested consolidation of ESDs, but just consolidation of issues and responsibilities that are created by Senate Bill 765 in its present form. Let me take us back briefly to 1990. 1990, and these numbers aren't important, but they're kind of close. There were about 550,000 school children in the state of Oregon. And let's assume that there were somewhere around 1 million parents. Well, given the representative republic in which we live, those 1 million people decided to entrust the management and the care of their children's education to school board members around the state, local school board members. So let's say there's about 12 or 1,300 of those and an average of 5 to 7 members per board. So at that time, there were 1,200 people. Well, then with the inception of Ballot Measure 5, basically all the money and all the power was transferred to 90 people in this building. And I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing. And what we're talking about is consolidation repeated and unchecked. And now we're coming down the path and we're going to put a tremendous burden at the feet of 7 people, and that's the State Board of Education. They're going to be able to, for all intents and purposes, with, I assume, some input from the department, determine the welfare of a great part of the education if we agree that ESDs do provide substantial services to kids all over the state. Those 7 people will be in a position to make live or die decisions for not only education service districts and the communities in which those districts reside, but also 500,000 kids around this state. I would suggest for a minute that any of those 7 people aren't genuinely concerned for the interest and welfare of all Oregon students. I just think that if we look at this, this is what consolidation does. We start at 1,200, we go to 90, and now we're at 7. And I'm not sure that's healthy for the state of Oregon. I would also be concerned that passing this bill in its present form has the potential to create de facto public policy. What it does is it provably will result in a reduction of both the quality and quantity of services to rural students throughout the state. The trouble with it is, if this isn't the bill's intent, the simple fact that it's not the intent won't lessen the harm done to Oregonians who live in rural areas. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Could you explain how it does that?
I was going to ask that
question
myself.
Madam Chair, Senator Decker.
It reduces services in rural parts of the state. How does it do that?
The bill, I'm making an assumption, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I'm making an assumption here that there will be, as the bill mandates, a consolidation of education service districts. History has shown that we're always on the block first. I'm not assuming that that will be the same way again. Consider this a preemptive strike. We've always been there. And I am concerned that we'll be there again, and quite frankly, I would like to get out in front of this instead of being behind it.
So you're talking about impacts on the formula?
No, actually, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, no, I'm not talking about impact on the formula. However, now that you mentioned the formula, let me throw one other thing out. I know that people are concerned about having the school districts involved in the business of ESDs, and I would suggest that if that's really what we're talking about, perhaps we should take a hard look at the funding formula that's proposed by the Frontier Rural ESDs, which essentially says that every ESD lives within its tax base. That redirects $105 million per year back into the schools in unconstrained funds. They're not new funds, but they're unconstrained by education service districts. Those school districts can then go out and buy services from whomever they wish. Now, I know we've talked about not affecting the formula, and I would also suggest that this doesn't affect the functionality of the formula, but rather simply takes the 5% allocation right off the top, so it affects it on a macro basis, but not the functionality.
Mr. Myers, you might have an opportunity to work on that funding formula and revenue under Senate Bill 415, because that's what the bill is going to be doing, is working on the funding formula. But that's for another day, because we have some other folks to hear from. I just wanted to make a statement. I had to smile about, you said people are concerned about school districts being involved in the budgets of ESDs and the financial matters. Well, I think they should, Mr. Myers. I think it's important for school districts to know how ESDs are spending the money for the services that come, that are provided by the ESDs. Don't you?
Madam Chair, I couldn't agree with you more, and if you inferred something else from what I said, then I apologize, because that's not what I meant. The process of the budget process in rural ESDs is very inclusive. I know, because I was there. I chaired the North Central ESD Board for 2 years, and I was chairman of the North Central Transition Committee, and I was also on the district board. So I'm relatively familiar with the budget process as it relates particularly to ours, and also to Olathe Region 18. The boards are intimately involved in the budget process of ESDs. I know that the district superintendents meet once a month in Condon from all six of the districts that are involved in North Central ESD, and it's in the bylaws and the directives that at least one board member from each school district is a part of the ESD budget committee. So I couldn't agree with you more. You can shine a bright light on us all you want.
Okay.
We're ready.
And maybe I misunderstood what you said, but that sort of made my hackles go up. So I'm glad we cleared that up.
I am too.
All right. I really appreciate you coming all the way from Condon. My husband had an aunt who lived in Condon for many years, and I know it's a long ways from here. So thank you very much for coming. And if you want to provide your written testimony, we can review that later.
Madam Chair, thank you. I will.
You're welcome. Okay, Ozzy Rose and Tricia Smith, can you come up here and finish out the half hour here? We've got 10 minutes. And then, colleagues, it'll take us about 25 to 30 minutes to punch through our agenda, and I like to be able to do that pretty quickly. Who would like to go first? It's your choice.
Go first.
Okay, Mr. Rose.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ozzy Rhodes. I reside at 1323 Jordan Drive South, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of ESDs. We are supportive of the bill. I have a couple notes about some change we like, but we are supportive of the bill in general. The work group essentially expanded the concepts that were in 765, which came from a project by the OASD, which we addressed the question of consolidation. And we took the stance that drawing a map wasn't the issue when you talk about services or ESDs. You should start with how do we deliver services and then draw the map. And we identified four core services that ought to be available on a regional basis. And those four core services wind up in Section 2 of your bill, and the work group expanded on those in great detail about what you would do in those core services areas. And Section 2 of the bill specifies the capacity that would be necessary to provide the services that we're talking about. The bill then directs the SPI to review the organization of ESDs and propose three alternative models. One, the existing status quo, and two others for reorganization aimed at better delivery of services required under the core services model. And there was an attempt by both our association, we worked on it, and I think the work group, to quit looking back. The history of this discussion is well known. We have it, and I wish Senator Decker was still here. You've had 37 years to decide it, what a number is, and you can't get it done in this kind of a debate. And it's rightfully so. The number is not important.
That's right.
You wouldn't build a business based on, I think we ought to have 8 or 10 or 12 somethings, and then build the business. You design the business of what it's going to do and how it's going to get revenue to accomplish the product or profit, whatever you're after, and then you structure the thing. And that's, I think, the real value of changing the debate we've had over this issue for so many years. So we support the methodology. We support driving the discussion at the district and ESD level. We support the concept of looking at what you want done over the next 20 years, and the next 20 years in education are much different, both in terms of our demands, in terms of the technology and resources that we have to carry out education, and that's how we ought to be looking at this issue. We do have one suggestion, although I think the legislation is pretty clear, that the State Department and Superintendent need to involve the local districts and the ESDs. Our folks in discussing it last week were uptight that it wasn't tight down tight, and they would either like legislative language or a budget note, at least if it goes through the Ways and Means process, that reminds the department that involving the districts and the ESDs is very, very important. We do oppose the governance changes. We understand why the election process and the number of board members was put in the bill, and we understand the budget stuff, what the motive behind this, and we believe that the addition of the local service plan, which, by the way, which doesn't get talked about much in these discussions, but the local service plan component of this is a very, very significant change in how we're going to do business and drives the discussion about what ESDs do to the local districts. And we think the local service plan plus the resolution process gives the districts enough structure and control, and there is value in the public election of board members keeps the citizen oversight. This is your best opportunity for systemic change in how regional agencies are designed to provide services to both kids and districts. It's done on a rational and logical approach. Start with what you want and then build a structure. I don't think anybody, proponents or opponents of change, would say you would build the structure we had right now if you had nothing and you're starting from nothing. And this is a way to address that. Vicki, I think, mentioned that this was a compromise. She used the word compromise on this issue of a map versus... I don't view it as a compromise. I view it as the first real rational thinking about how you might go about this process. And to Representative Morissette, Mr. Hitchcock was part of the ESD superintendents group that I met with last week when they made a decision to support this. And everybody's a little tight. If you read the bill one way, you can read it that an ESD no longer exists except to do what they're told by the State Department and do what they're told by local districts. And there was a lot of uneasiness about that. But the, and about do we have the resources to do everything? Probably you don't. But the issue of the local service plan, these are the things that should be in it. And you come to this item, and we've got to do the special ed. I don't think anybody, you can't possibly back away from the kinds of monies that Lane is providing in their local districts for special ed. These other things have to be done. Can we do them? If we can't, they don't get done. Or can we get them from another ESD? Can we do this? Can we do that? Can you build around one district's ability to do it for other districts? How do you address that issue? If it comes up across the state, how many ESDs we have, or regional service agents, and all of them say, we cannot get to this particular item. We can't do the assessment. There just aren't enough resources. That's going to be a message to the department and to you folks about how we're going to carry out the business of the enterprise. There aren't enough resources to do it. It doesn't say you've got to take what resource you have and spread them over everything and get them done. And I believe that's important. And that was really hard discussion because we had the Dash 2 amendments, which on this issue aren't much different than Dash 3s. And when you just read through them the first time and you're used to operating the system, those are the kind of things that you get worried about. But I do believe when we get a little more discussion that those issues aren't as they appear and were presented to you the other day. With that, I'll be quiet unless you have questions. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. I do have a question. I just want to be clear on what changes you wanted in the bill. You wanted to change the governance aspect. You don't want, you still want to retain elected board members.
I'm sure that's correct. We would drop the reference to changing the board and the budget committee.
Okay. And then you want to tie down the language about involving the districts and the ESDs. Okay. Is that clear?
Yes.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith, and I apologize for my lovely new voice. I think at the end I'm going to have a good singing voice. In the meantime, it's puberty, and I'm sorry. OSCA. I will do the best I can with this. OSCA supports the effort of the legislature to make reforms to education service districts to address problems that have come forward in the last few years. We support legislation that addresses gaps in ESD governance and accountability statutes that have allowed ESDs to make imprudent fiscal decisions contrary to the best interest of students, taxpayers, and the public. However, OSEA doesn't support the concept of consolidation of ESDs as a solution to that problem necessarily, unless there is an identified specific operational improvement in the educational services to students in districts served by ESDs. We believe that serving students is the primary focus of every educational agency, including ESDs, and should remain so. Having said that, we have some concerns about the -3 amendments as they have been drafted, and I'll try to go through those for you as quickly as I can, Madam Chair. The first issue that we have is in the way that that ESDs will have to prove capacity in order to be considered as regional education service agencies in Section 2. One of them, for example, you've heard in prior testimony there's some concern about the capacity of ESDs to accomplish all of these things. And you've also heard that they might not have to accomplish all of these things unless the service plan requires that they do. I would suggest to you that whether or not they're required to do these things, the language in the amendment requires they have the capacity to do these things. They have, as the bill says, shall at a minimum have the capacity to and then do these things, including have a sufficient number of employees to provide accounting services to school districts and to provide oversight of school district fiscal practices. Now, it seems to me that if you have the capacity to provide accounting services for your school districts, that means you've got a big accounting department. ESDs don't have that at this point. There's nothing in the bill that would require districts who are relieved of those services to transfer funds to the ESD that now would be required to provide them, as I read the language of the bill. That's one of the issues. Sub-E in that same subsection says, demonstrate the ability to facilitate school district performance audits and strategic reviews of school district operations. I'd like to get back to that in just a moment, and I wanted to highlight it so that I could. Our next issue deals with the governance as it's developed in this -3 amendment. We do not support the concept of the budget committee of the ESD being made up of superintendents of component school districts, nor do we support the concept in the -3 amendments that component school district boards would elect five ESD board members who would then appoint four others. We find nothing in this language to indicate that members of the public, taxpayers, parents, and others interested in the governance of schools has any input into this other than in a very removed way when they're dealing with their school district boards. We believe that more sunshine, not less sunshine, more public input, not less public input, is better for agencies big and small. And we would hope that the committee would reinstitute the public back into this process. Understand that sometimes it's a lot more efficient for a few people to get together and decide what's going to happen and then just do it. But unfortunately, and if I have my numbers correctly, the governor's budget proposes something around $330 million going to ESDs directly. The department indicates another $200 million goes out to ESDs in grants. And there may be other money that I haven't counted, but that's up around $500 million. And that's not chump change. We think that the public should be involved in how decisions are made at the ESD level as well as the school district level in making these decisions. And we hope that as you continue to work forward on these issues, that you will consider those things. The last point that we have, the last couple of points I have to make are, with the governance as it is in the -3 amendments, when I visualize how this will work, school districts would determine the superintendents that would serve on the budget committee, and the budget committee would determine the budget plan. And the budget plan would then go to the ESD board, again appointed by school district boards. And then they would go out and they would implement that plan. Back to the things that they might have to do, or at least have to prove they have the capacity to do, is performance audits of school districts. So let's see, school district superintendents create and run the ESD that is going to go back and audit school districts to determine whether or not they're effectively managing their programs. I see a circular scenario that leaves the public out and allows an enabling process that prevents us from ever really knowing what should be happening there. And with that, I think my voice is about giving you all it can, and I'll answer any questions.
Okay. Ms. Smith, you have your testimony in writing.
No, ma'am. I'm sorry. I do not.
Okay. Can you get it in writing and provide it to the committee? That would be great.
Thank you.
I did follow you, but
thank you.
You might have lost a few words here and there. So.
About every third word, I guess, is what.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Morsette, did you have a comment?
Oh, no. I just wanted it in writing. Also.
Okay. You
That'd
too.
Be fine. Thank
Senator
you.
Senator Cruz?
Well, I guess in response to the circular thing, it's not quite circular. It does go to the department. So the accountability, that's where the accountability ends up. So that's not totally circular.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll look forward to your written testimony. Thank you very much. I think Senator Cruz and I need to have a discussion with the work group. Well, this is good. This is what we wanted to hear, and that's why we're not moving this bill today. I think we have a good product that needs just a little bit more discussion, and we'll do that. So thank you, committee. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 765. We've got 25 minutes, which the committee administrator assures me we can whip through these, so we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 958. Representative Avakian is in the room somewhere. Jeff, can you holler at them out there? Yeah, I did. Representative Buckian, we opened a public hearing. We are running close on time. Have a seat. Introduce yourself. Tell us what you want.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for opening the hearing today. I understand that this bill may be moved to the Revenue Committee, which I am in support of. And actually, Karen Heikis, why don't you just come up with me?
Okay, that'd be great. And then
It'll
you can introduce yourself.
Thank you.
Jim wants to speak too.
Of course.
Are you for or again?
30 seconds each, folks, and then we'll let this committee get on with their business.
I don't know if I can do it.
Brad Avakian, State Representative, District 34, Northeast Washington County. The bill pertains to reasonable limitations on the amount of money that can flow from a school district to charter schools. I understand the chair will not be taking action on the bill, which I agree with today. I've put together a work group to make some modifications to the bill that we will be presenting to the Revenue Committee after the bill moves there.
Okay. And you're right. The bill in its present form is not acceptable. So,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Karen Heikis, Charter Schools Development Center, and I definitely concur that the bill in its current form is not good for students, charter schools, or districts. And I believe that the real issue is to define a term in the current charter school law, which is adverse impact, which districts are allowed to use certain criteria for determining whether to accept or deny a charter school proposal up front. And one of those criteria is if the district can identify direct, identifiable, significant, and adverse impact to the students in that district, then the charter school can be denied. And I think that issue needs to be defined. And I think that's really the underlying issue. But again, as the bill currently stands, I would not support it, and I would be happy to be involved in Representative Avakian's work group to define adverse impact and to take a look at, you know, how to kind of address the issues that are embedded in this bill.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Green?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. I spoke briefly with Representative Avakian out in the hallway about his idea of a work group to discuss some of the terms and ideas surrounding the issue he wants to address. We're supportive of that. Would be willing to work on that work group and report back to either this committee or the Revenue Committee.
Well, I think we've had our fill of work groups at the moment, so I think we're going to give this one to Revenue to take a peek at. Senator Starr? Would you have a motion for me? But actually, I'm closing the public hearing, opening a work session. Now, Senator Starr.
Yes.
You're welcome.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 958 to Committee on Revenue.
Without recommendation, Senator Starr?
Well, that we... without recommendations.
All right. Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 958 without recommendations. This Committee on Revenue, Senate Committee on Revenue. Any comments? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 9, the work session on Senate Bill 958. Thank you. That's what happens when we get in a hurry. Okay, next we're going to whip up to opening a work session on Senate Bill 187.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you last heard Senate Bill 187 on the 9th of March. At that time, we heard from Community Colleges and Workforce Development that they had a little cleanup amendment that they proposed. That is the -1 amendment that's attached to your staff measure summary. It clarifies that legislators appointed to the board are non-voting members and will serve in an advisory capacity only. And it deletes requirements for the Workforce Investment Board and regional workforce committees to develop specific five-year strategic plans that allows flexibility if perhaps they need two-year plans instead of five-year plans. I know that Kim Price-Brawley is here if you have any questions about that amendment.
Okay, that sounds like a pretty straightforward amendment. Does anyone have any questions? Do you need someone to come up and visit with us? Okay. Hearing none, Senator Starr, give a motion.
Madam Chair, I move -1 amendments to Senate Bill 187.
Senator Starr moves the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 187. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Starr.
I move Senate Bill 187 as amended to the Senate floor for due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 187 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Close the work session on Senate Bill 187. Who would like to carry that bill? Any volunteers? Senator Morissette, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Okay. We whipped out two bills while we were waiting for Senator Carter. That's great. Senator Carter, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 703. If you want to come up while Marjorie tells us all about this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 703 permits the issuance of a teaching personnel service or administrative license or registration to a person convicted of prostitution who meets certain requirements. This bill allows the school district to employ or contract with a person convicted of prostitution if that person meets requirements. However, we received the -1 amendment from Senator Carter's office that allows the TSPC and school districts to determine whether a person is fit to be a teacher who's been convicted of prostitution or an equivalent crime, rather than the person meeting the certain requirements that are identified in the printed bill.
Senator Carter, who's joining you at the table?
Madam Chair. My name is Kevin Feeney. I'm a legal intern for Senator Carter.
Okay, nice to meet you.
So proud.
The microphone?
Yes, I am so proud of him. That's why I want him to introduce himself, because he's all nervous. Kevin is the nephew of a long-term Feeney man that have been here with the Department of Transportation issues from TriMet for a long time. And they worked in my office, and I didn't even know it.
He
was related to Dick Feeney.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay.
Madam Chair, thank you very, very much, and members of the committee, for
the record, my name is Margaret Carter, and I represent Senate District 22 North Northeast Portland. I want to thank you very much for taking the time out to hear this presentation today, because sometimes when we create a law, even though we have good intentions, we throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let me just explain that, because I don't just like using trite statements. Because I think many times we think that we're doing the best, and when in fact we're not. In this case, we may be victimizing the victim. Prostitution can be and often is a crime of victimization. The individual is caught, sometimes not of one's own choosing. And if one could think right in a downward spiral, which is what is happening to many of the women in this victimized state, they could think better. But, you know, when the wind is blowing hard and you're in a spiral, spiraling down condition, it's hard for you to think. And so it drives one's emotions and their confusions and their loss of trust, loss of self, loss of the ability to clearly self-reflect, loss of resources, and certainly support systems and loss of access to care, loss of a roof over your head, and or meals on one's plate. As you know, Madam Chair, my work in this community has expanded over 35 years. And I can say, as a professional counselor, that prostitution is a form of self-destruction. And that when someone can rise from this victimization, from this spiral of self-destruction, we should not place eternal barriers to that individual's upward bound. It appears to me that these young women and men, in many cases, need an opportunity to make a true life and to be able to revitalize their lives, to have a career to support their families. What our society once called throwaways should not be throwaways for life. This is what was called white slavery at one time. I need not tell you that once prominent men in Portland and elsewhere in our state made fortunes from prostitution and victimization. As a matter of fact, when I was in graduate school, we looked at one of the former mayors of the city of Portland had the biggest prostitution rings in the city. And there was obviously a lot of gratification going on and money-making at the time. I feel that our current law is too severe and without forgiveness. And Senator Starr, I think you just did a presentation on the floor about 2 weeks ago about forgiveness, and it is a basic premise of my own spirituality in that many times we are too hardline on that particular area. Right now, as it stands in law, a man or woman has a past conviction of prostitution under ORS 167.007. It's a class demeanor. The doors are shut for a lifetime to a career in public life. I am not here promoting prostitution whatsoever, so I want to make that very, very clear. However, I do make the distinction from ORS 167.017, which is a Class B felony, which is to induce or cause spouse, child, or stepchild of the person to engage in prostitution. This is not ORS 167.017. This bill does not apply to the promotion of prostitution to the madam or the promoter under a separate statute, which is ORS 167.012. And I ask you to, and I think that we've provided you, well, John is doing it now, giving you a handout. And I'd like for you to actually look at that handout that I have provided to you to note the distinction. I have become aware of young women and older women who are on a pathway upward out of this lifestyle, sometimes years, even decades. Decades later, women actually in established careers or educational tracks having to leave their career employment or career ladder from a mistake or indiscretion at a younger age. The irony of this is our history. At one time, maybe a surprise to some of you, both the Republican Dorchester Conference and the Oregon Democratic Party have advocated some form of decriminalization of prostitution as late as the 1970s. I am not here to advocate for the practice again. I'm here to ask you to remove the lifetime barriers to individuals who may, after careful review, be acceptable to employment. The amendment before you would allow the Teacher Standard and Practices Commission and the local districts, after careful review, to decide whether an employee is fit to be a teacher. This bill, as proposed to be amended, is carefully tailored and would not apply to violent crimes and crimes against children. The decision rests with the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission and the local district to determine whether the person is fit to be a teacher. This most specifically came to my attention this year, Madam Speaker. When we look at this law, it is under, or in the same arena as murderers and other heavily induced crimes, and I feel that if a person wants to clean themselves up and start their life all over again, if it has been a misdemeanor, that lifetime barriers should not be in, stand in the way of that kind of activity, but that the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission would have the opportunity to look at that person's past, to look at their present, and then determine present situation, and then determine if they're fit to be a teacher. That's on today with this bill. That's why I'm asking you to support me on giving people who have spiraled down and now are on the rebound and have taken charge of their lives and have cleared their lives up to have a second chance and not have a lifetime barrier against work opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Carter.
Sure.
Do you want to say something, Mr. Feeney?
I don't know how well I can follow that up, but we have obtained a copy of a research report that was conducted recently in the year 2000 by the Mary Magdalene Project, which is a nonprofit group working recovering prostitutes in Southern California. And a lot of what we found in here supports the idea that a lot of these people are being victimized and re-victimized by the law as it is now. And I believe we've handed out some charts to you. One of them is showing that of the pool of people that they interviewed, 87% of the prostitutes had been sexually abused as children. Another one of the charts, I'm not sure if it made it up there, shows the average age.
We have that.
The average age? Okay, where people are starting in the careers of prostitution, with the most common age being 15.
Yeah, that's this chart right here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And what that means to me then is that, you know, this is kind of ongoing victimization. You have people who are abused as children who are entering prostitution as children, and for that matter, I guess, they are being punished for something when the acts they're involved in are criminal on two levels. One, because prostitution is criminal, but also because it's statutory rape to have sexual relations with a minor. And I think that helps paint the picture of where a lot of these women stand and are coming from. And I think to prevent or limit the opportunities that these women have to reform their lives and become productive members of society is exactly a form of re-victimization, because we're not giving them any opportunities. And a lot of these people are people that are kind of ongoing victims of this abuse.
Madam Chair, this data that Kevin has here also speak to the issue of showing that that of the categories of women involved in prostitution, white women were the largest category at 47%, blacks were second at 36%, Hispanics were third at 8%. This reminds me of last summer, summer before last, a group of young ladies, 12 and 13 years of age, were being taken from their homes in Lake Oswego here in Oregon, either last summer or summer before last, and taken up to Canada and put on the streets and were held beyond their own desires many times. And so there was a big crackdown on this kind of activities. When those young ladies become 25 or become 18 or whatever it is, these kind of things are on their records and they can't ever put it behind them. They can't put the victimization piece behind them. Then we further victimize them by saying, you are a throwaway, you are nothing, you cannot get a decent job in this community. And a lot of times, as you know, education is one of the places where people always feel as if they want to make a difference, that compassionate, caring arena. And so what I'd like to see happen is that these women, and in some instances young boys, these young men, have a second opportunity, have a second chance.
Thank you, Senator. I think I'll ask Vicki Chamberlain to come up. If you can stay, Senator, we'll have Vicki come up and talk about the amendment, and you can answer any questions.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Executive Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. We're here to support the bill and the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments clearly give the commission the discretion to decide on a case-by-case basis whether or not to license the applicant. And the two cases that I have seen in the 3 years that I've been here for licensure have been very cut and dried. One of them was a young woman who was convicted when she was 18 years old, and she was in her 30s, and she had done a career change and had decided to go back to school and actually had completed her program before they discovered that she had a conviction of prostitution and paid for it. Well, as it turned out, she had the resources to go back and expunge it from her record, which requires us to treat it as though it never happened. The other case I had was an out-of-state applicant who had been a teacher in another state for a number of years, because this is not a crime that prohibits licensure in every state, and we had to just deny her licensure based on the conviction. So not every situation is the same, and with this amendment, the commission can use all the facts to make the decision, the recency, the intervening events, anything else that may have occurred at the time, the age of the person at the time, and so given that, we support the proposed bill.
Well, thank you, Ms. Chamberlain. I appreciate that interest in the bill. What does my committee feel like doing? Do you have nods and thumbs up? Okay, great. Well, we'll close this public hearing then. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 703 and I'll open a work session. Senator Starr.
Move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 703.
Senator Starr moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 703. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Second motion.
Move Senate Bill 703 to the floor with the big pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 703 to the floor of the Senate with F to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Carter, would you like to carry your bill?
I'd love to, Madam Chair. And I'm feeling a little bit. I want to thank Vicki Chamberlain and the people who helped us to look at this bill and give these other young women a chance, because it's so... It is so important to so many young women's lives. I don't think we realize as a society how many of these young women have been victimized and how they had no control over that victimization. And then they clean their lives up, go back to college, and I'm just excited. I'm excited.
Well,
thank you.
I'm glad you are, Senator Carter, and I appreciate your discussion about forgiveness. And I did appreciate when Senator Starr discussed that on the floor. I don't think we think about that as a human race very often, or often enough, let's put it that way.
Thank you.
So thank you. We look forward to seeing you on the floor. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 703. We're going to, Senator Starr has to leave at 5 o'clock, so we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 543.
Madam Chair, members of the committee,
for some reason I forgot to identify when we last heard this bill, but it was in the past.
I think it was March 9th.
Thank you. It was March 9th when we last heard this bill. And it directs the community colleges, state institutions of higher ed to treat veterans and current National Guard members who return from deployment in combat zones as residents for the purpose of admission. The Dash 1 amendment that you should have in your packet clarifies that community colleges and universities shall allow veterans of the armed forces of the United States to pay in-state tuition. It deleted the reference that was in the bill to National Guard and National Guard of all other states in the United States. However, one thing I'd like to bring up is that we've touched base with the Legislative Fiscal Office about the fiscal impact of this measure, and they've responded that the university system has identified a minimum of approximately 120 individuals system-wide who are now paying non-resident tuition who would probably be eligible for this in-state tuition. So they are suggesting that the fiscal impact will certainly be over the $50,000 threshold, and the reason I bring that up is that this bill does not have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but perhaps if you don't send it to Ways and Means, you might get a fiscal impact on it.
Oh,
just FYI.
You know, Madam Chair, if I could, when we were talking to the department about the unregistered students getting in-state tuition, they talked about that as being additional revenue, not a decrease in revenue.
That was the same thought that went through my head.
Okay, you can't play both sides of this.
The reduction in revenue in 0507 would be well in excess of $50,000. Our U.S. budget is developed around the amount of anticipated tuition, so this bill is needed in Ways and Means to consider that in context. I'm just telling you.
Well,
I think that to continue this discussion, I think Senator Starr brought that up on that bill that we were talking about the children of immigrant parents who are not yet legal residents. The university system was not going to get that tuition anyway because these kids were not in the system because they couldn't afford the non-resident tuition. This identifies kids who are already in the system, or people, at 120 existing individuals in the system. That's
well,
the distinction with the difference.
Maybe, Madam Chair, except for the fact that I don't think they looked to see if any of those undocumented students were actually already enrolled at they looked in one case, they didn't look in the other. If it needs to go to Ways and Means, so be it, but I prefer it not.
Okay. Senator Starr, what do you think we ought to do here?
I think that we better get a fiscal. I'd move it to the floor if the president thinks that's improper. He could send it back to us.
Okay.
Madam Chair, we might actually move it across the floor before they could develop a fiscal, and if there is one, they could deal with it on the House side.
That's true, and actually, we've got an amendment that they wanted to make on the House side. Mr. Caldwell, Mr. McDonald, can you come up here and give us 30 seconds, please?
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, we will certainly not drop this bill before we have some sort of fiscal statement. So if you send it to the floor instead of Ways and Means, I believe that the Legislative Fiscal Office would have to develop a fiscal statement rather than giving us some sort of hall pass to send it down to Ways and Means. So
okay.
It would just be more definitive.
Okay. Gentlemen, identify yourselves and make it pretty quick.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director, Oregon Military Department.
Thank you.
Dash 1 amendment's fine. I see no issues with that as far as I'm concerned. I think with reference to your fiscal issue, I would invite you to read the current law because I think it does nothing more than the current law allows. So if there's a fiscal, it's a new one because they can do most of this right now. So I can't see where the fiscal would be.
Okay.
And that's a cursory review, and that's ORS 351.642, and the exact same language is in the community college statutes too, because we did this last session actually, and that's under 341-529.
Okay. We appreciate that input.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt McDonald, representing Oregon Veterans. On lines 10, 12, 26, and 28, you have dishonorable discharge, released with other than a dishonorable discharge. There are other, two other discharges that are in the same capacity. They're undesirable discharge from the armed forces. It would be better wording if we put released under honorable conditions, and this will cover any changes the federal government makes in the discharge law, which incidentally just changed last year. But this would cover you in the future.
Okay. So is that the only recommended change?
That's the only recommendation change we have.
Would you assume that Representative Nelson would be willing to make that change?
Yes, I would. Because we've made the change on other bills in her committee.
And Senator Cruz, I'm always loathe to send things over that we don't have complete, but we, you know, this time of year we get into that time crunch, and I think I can entrust Mr. McDonald to take the message to Representative Nelson that this is the change, and whoever carries this bill on the floor
can put it on the record
yes. as well.
Yes.
And I agree with you, Senator Cruz and Colonel Caldwell. I think we just move this to the floor. If there's a fiscal, it comes back. And are you of that same mind, Senator Morissette? Okay, then, Senator Morissette, do you have a motion for me about a dash one amendment?
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 543.
Senator Morissette moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 543. Any discussion? The only discussion would be that we'll make the change over in the House that we want to.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 543.
Wait, oops. Okay. There was any objection? Hearing none. Second motion?
I move Senate Bill 543 to the floor of the Senate with a new pass recommendation.
As amended.
Thank you. And the dash one was accepted. Senator Morissette moves Senate Bill 543 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. And I believe that's Senator Cordley's bill. So we're going to have her carry that. Okay, Sean? All right.
Make sure she makes the reference to the amendments.
All right.
In her speech. So.
Thank you very much. Okay, colleagues, we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 543. We're going to open the work session on Senate Bill 575.
Marjorie. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 575 was last heard on the 9th of March. It gives students at community colleges and state institutions of higher education and OHSU who are members of the National Guard and are ordered to serve active duty certain rights relating to their courses in which they're enrolled when they actually go on to active duty. And other provisions. At that time, we heard from Senator Devlin that there were a couple little issues that needed to be cleared up. You have the dash two amendment in your packet. It clarifies language associated with scholarships funded by the Oregon Student Assistance Commission and clarifies that community college boards, not the State Board of Higher Education, will adopt rules for implementation at the community colleges. And during our meeting today, we had a note sent by the Community College Association that they were in support of the dash twos on 575.
Okay. And Max, did you have a comment on this one?
Yes. For the record, my name is Matt McDonald, representing Oregon Veterans. On line 7, I like added in there all armed forces reservists. When I was in the armed forces, the governor of California asked that Marine reservists be activated to help fight forest fires, and this was done, and this would just cover them.
Okay, and as Senator Cruz asked a while ago, you think Representative Nelson would be agreeable to that kind of a change?
I don't think there'll be any problem.
Okay, terrific. All right, and this is Senator Devlin's bill. All right. Have you discussed that, Mr. McDonald? Can you come back just for a second, please? Have you discussed that change with Senator Devlin?
No, ma'am, I haven't, but I can. I don't see where there'd be any problem whatsoever
okay.
with it.
Well, we're not going to vote on it on this okay. side, but you might just stop by his office and say that we had a discussion.
I would be glad the West Marines can talk to each other.
Oh, yes, you can. Thank you so much for watching out for the veterans. And we have a letter from the Oregon University System we will admit into the record where they indicate they are supportive of Dash 2 amendments from the Chancellor, George Pearlsteiner. So with that being said, Senator Morstead?
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments. Are they two?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 575.
Senator Morstead moves the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 575. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Okay. Are we going to send this to the floor or Ways and Means? Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 575 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morstead moves Senate Bill 575 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. That will go to Senator Devlin to carry. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 575. You know, if we started on time, we'd be ending on time today. So I take blame for that.
You're too late, Richard.
Yeah, Senator Devlin, you're carrying that bill. Okay, we're going to open a work session on our last bill of the day, Senate Bill 766.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 766 was last heard on March 14th. The printed bill limits the amount of salary and benefits the school districts, ESDs, or public charter schools can pay an administrator at the end of their contract and prohibits the districts or schools from granting administrators retirement benefits not available to other employees. The Dash 1 amendments have been provided to your committee members. They replace the original measure, define administrator in school, prohibits school districts, ESDs, and charter schools from entering into contracts that grant these administrators very specific benefits. It allows the schools to make contributions to an administrator's retirement plan in lieu of contributions to PERS, but those contributions cannot exceed contributions that would have been made to PERS, and it applies to contracts on or after the effective date of the measure, and it declares an emergency, takes effect on passage.
Well, thank you, Ms. Taylor. Colleagues, I kind of liked this bill. It had some problems, as was pointed out by Mr. Marshall and Mr. Bennett on March 14th. So I had Ms. Smith address those, and that's what you see in the Dash 1 amendment here. And it preserves the retirement benefits of someone who's not in PERS, and it takes care of some of the other issues that they express concern about. I do want to tell you that I was a little bit concerned about the comment that was made in committee where Mr. Bennett said that we don't have the infrastructure to develop our own administrators and we have to go outside of the state. I'm really disappointed to hear that. I think we have a lot of good people in the state and we ought to be focusing on that. So that's just sort of a side comment. Do you have any questions, either of my committee members who remain?
Well, I mean, this is a significant change from the bill as it originally was. So I'm trying to digest it, Madam Chair.
All right. Do you want some discussion from Ms. Smith? She can't talk very well, but...
We also have Mr. Marshall.
And we also have Mr. Marshall in the back. So why don't you both come up? Okay.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tricia Smith for the record.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the amendment?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, the Dash 1 amendment was designed to address three things that were brought up in the hearing. And the first was that the definition of administrator was limited to licensed administrators. And as I mentioned in my testimony, there is a trend in school districts to hire administrators at the executive level that do not have licenses by TSPC. And the chair asked that those non-licensed administrators be included in the bill so that issues such as that Portland Public experienced would be covered. The second change in the amendment was there was a blank in the original bill as to what the severance package would be limited to, and the amendment limits it to 25% of the annual salary the administrator received in the prior year. This is the amount of severance that can be granted an administrator. That equals 3 months of severance pay. And then the third amendment was in Section 2, and it dealt with the concern that the person from COSA offered in the testimony that when they recruit administrators from out of state, they need to be competitive, and one way they can be competitive, and because administrators work for an average, according to Mr. Bennett, of 3 to 5 years, that it was not competitive to offer PERS as a pension package when these administrators may have an existing pension plan that they would prefer contributions be made to. Currently, districts pay PERS for these administrators, and in addition to what they pay for PERS, many of them are offering additional pensions and pension packages to these administrators. This amendment allows the district to offer at the request of the administrator in a one-time selection before their first 6 months of employment when they would be PERS eligible, they can choose to have their employer contribution put into an existing or an alternative retirement plan rather than PERS so that they will not lose money in their pension by coming to work in Oregon. So we believe that that amendment embodied in Section 2 would satisfy the concern of the districts. And that is what the bill amendment does.
And so, Madam Chair, so we are constraining when a school district is trying to hire a superintendent, for example. They can do whatever they want salary-wise at this point, but we're constraining the benefits they can offer?
Under the bill, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, under the bill, the retirement benefits are constrained to the amount that the employer would put into PERS. That's how they are constrained. They are able to, and in some ways it frees up what they can do with superintendents or administrators, because right now they are required under the law to contribute to PERS for that administrator. And this would allow the administrator to choose whether that contribution should go to PERS or to another pension plan.
I understand that. However, under current law, they aren't restricted. They're required to put into PERS, but they aren't restricted from doing other things. And, you know, I guess there's a limiting factor in lieu of salary where somebody, the salary may be okay, but a carrot you're hanging out for them is the benefit package. And I would hate to think that, I mean, because it's all reportable stuff, and I'm just, I just don't know why we want to put that restriction on it.
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. Senator Cruz, the purpose of the bill was to try to deal with the what we consider to be the excessive contract amounts in severance and pensions that are being offered, and in some cases we believe are being extracted from school districts by superintendents or superintendent candidates to the tunes of hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's what we're trying to restrict here and keep them in reasonable bounds. These are public employees.
And I understand that, and we can go to a couple of examples in Portland. I won't name any names, and I understand that. I'm just wondering if, you know, and you get out into the other part of the state, we don't see these lucrative things, and I'm just wondering if this is going to be an undue restriction on hiring somebody in Myrtle Creek. So, I mean, you know, and I don't know. That's what I'm just wondering. I mean, you have limiting benefits available here.
But I don't think that Myrtle Creek would pay a whole lot of money to have Superintendent Senator Cruz. I mean, like what we're talking about here.
And, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, if I could offer one other tidbit of information, it is to remind you that at this point, the contribution, if you include the 6% employee contribution in PERS, it's somewhere around 24% of salary that can be available to superintendents right now in their pension, which is a significantly generous pension.
Okay. Well, I can say,
do you want to hear from Mr. Marshall?
Yeah. Am I still on hot air here? I usually am, so if I am, just say so.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association.
I think Mr. Marshall's going to agree with that statement. So if you're looking for an agreement, he won't give that to you.
You're absolutely right, Madam Chair. There have been, as Ms. Smith has pointed out, several circumstances that have received quite a bit of press coverage regarding the compensation of a superintendent upon his retirement and other individuals that have been employed by administrators in school districts. I do not believe that it's necessary to enact a bill that will impact hundreds of school superintendents and school administrators and our ability to attract and retain quality individuals into that profession. As I indicated in my testimony when you heard the bill several weeks ago, the pool of individuals that are qualified is extremely shallow, and we have to compete with other states to try to get folks to come to Oregon and serve in these positions. As I said in that testimony, these administrator contracts are public documents, and when a school board negotiates a contract with their superintendent or their chief executive officer, I believe there's a certain amount of accountability in terms of what they're paying that individual, and those locally elected bodies have to make that case to their community. In terms of the definition of administrator, there are a number of individuals that work in school districts that aren't licensed. You have a business manager. Some school districts might have an accounting, a director of accounting, a chief financial officer, a transportation director, a food services director, and those individuals all serve the school district under an employment contract.
Mr. Marshall, I have to interrupt you because the amendment addresses that issue by saying that you're not required to be licensed.
Well, Madam Chair, I was referring to those folks that are included in that definition, mm-hmm. that are not licensed individuals but work in a school district and would fall under that definition of administrator.
Okay.
Many school districts, and in fact, a bill was passed several sessions ago that allows certain school districts in counties, I believe it was under 35,000 population, to hire individuals that have retired under the public employees retirement system to continue to work without meeting the limitations in statute regarding the number of hours they can still work while they're receiving their retirement benefits. The reason for the passage of that bill was to create a better pool of individuals that might be willing to work in smaller school districts in more isolated areas of the state. And as you know, there are many individuals that are retiring under the public employees retirement system at a relatively early age that maybe not be ready to give up their work, but would be persuaded to go to work in some of those areas where it's very difficult to attract individuals. In response to Senator Cruz's question, does this impose a constraint on the ability of individual school districts to negotiate with individuals and enter into contracts with individuals to work within the school district? And it does. I think the circumstance, and I don't know all the details surrounding the contract from the superintendent here in Salem, but I do know that at least in terms of some of the contracts that were entered into in the Portland area, that if you enter into a contract and there are provisions of that contract that if you allow that individual, if you in effect fire the individual without cause, that you still owe a payment under that contract. what we do in working with school districts is to be very, very careful in entering into those contracts, because an individual may be great in the interviews, you may think they're a wonderful individual, you may hire them, and 6 months down the road they don't work out. You need an ability to send that person down the road without creating a massive financial obligation. So we continually work with school districts to have them beware of the kind of contractual obligations into which they enter. And I would encourage you not to impose these kinds of constraints on our ability to attract and retain good people into those administrator ranks.
Question, Senator Morissette.
Is there a restraint on the amount of salary that can be paid?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, there is not.
Okay. Then what's the problem? You can give them the compensation package. There's no limit if you want to attract someone. You can pay them four times as much as they're probably worth, but four times. And all this does is limit the retirement. I think it's very reasonable. I think the package is a hidden part of a lot of contracts. I mean, people know what the salary is, but they're not always aware of this sleeper that is in the contract that I think this bill addresses. I think it's a good bill, and if they really want to attract a person, they can pay them what that person wants. So I don't see a problem with this bill.
Any other questions, Senator Cruz?
No, and thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not quite there.
Okay, well, because we're not quite there yet, I'm going to hold this bill over till Wednesday. Under the rules, I can do that. I thank you for your testimony, Ms. Marshall and Ms. Smith, and we will officially hold Senate Bill 766 over to the Wednesday agenda. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 766, and colleagues, we are done, and I appreciate your work. Wednesday, we are going to be here quite late, so at least 6, because that's the last day to punch out all this stuff. So pack your lunch. We're adjourned.